from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. 2 months after the death of an Argentine prosecutor, more details have emerged over recent allegations concerning the circumstances of the death of Alberto Nisman, found dead in January, a day before he was set to bring formal allegations against leftist President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, claiming that she was involved in an effort to cover up alleged Iranian involvement in the bombing of a Buenos Aires Jewish community center in 1994. The bombing, which took place during the term of then-President Carlos Menem, left 85 people dead and hundreds injured. 21 years later, no one has ever been held responsible for the incident. But after weeks of speculation by the private media in Latin America and the U.S. that the president was somehow involved in Nisman's killing, the late prosecutor's ex-wife came forward and said he was murdered by a co-worker in a dispute over money that the two were diverting from the investigation's funds to their personal use. Nisman's ex, Sandra Arroyo Salgado, said that Diego Lagomarsino, a computer technician hired by Nisman to work on the case, killed Nisman over money issues. She pointed to the fact that Lagomarsino's gun was found at the crime scene as evidence. In addition, the forensic team she hired claims that Nisman died on January 17th, which observers said suggests that he could have been in the apartment at the time of Nisman's death. Ms. Arroyo had petitioned the Argentine courts to remove Viviana Fine, the prosecutor in charge of investigating his death, from the case. She accused Fine of steering the investigation away from the hypothesis that Nisman's death was a homicide. A judge denied her petition Wednesday. In response to the recent allegations, Lagomarsino's lawyer, Maximiliano Risconi, claimed that Nisman was siphoning off half of Lagomarsino's salary and had been doing so for 7 years. That salary came from a government fund meant to be used to investigate the 1994 bombing, which Nisman administered. After four successive presidential administrations had failed to solve the case, President Fernandez's predecessor, the late President Nestor Kirchner, her deceased husband, appointed Nisman as special prosecutor of the probe. Nisman first accused Iran of involvement back in 2006. On Thursday, President Fernandez called upon the Argentinian justice system to take steps toward solving the case and requested that the government of Israel allow its former ambassador, Itzhak Aviron, to testify and clarify recent remarks he made surrounding the bombing. Last week, Aviron told an Israeli media outlet that Israel had already killed the terrorists behind the attack. President Fernandez criticized the way in which the case had been handled in recent months, saying, quote, "It's become clearer and more obvious than ever that the bombing is part of a national and international political chessboard," closed quote. Emergency talks in Brussels over Greece's debt once again brought no results, except for another warning from the EU's leaders, who want Athens to present a comprehensive list of economic reforms to satisfy lenders' demands. But this again gave the Greek prime minister an opportunity to express his optimistic view of chances for a deal. However, on both the negotiations with Greece and on sanctions with Russia, cracks are beginning to appear within the EU. Press TV's Jerome Hughes filed this report from Brussels.
Based on the varying opinions expressed by EU heads of government at this summit in Brussels, it is clear that the European Union lacks unity. On Russia, some EU countries would like to see tougher sanctions against Moscow over the crisis in Ukraine, while others would favour a more diplomatic approach. Russia denies any involvement in the crisis. The EU leaders eventually agreed to tie current sanctions against Moscow to a peace deal reached last month in the Belarus capital, Minsk.
The European Council agreed that the duration of economic sanctions will be clearly linked to the complete implementation of the Minsk agreements.
Greece bailout talks also dominated the conversation. On the sidelines of the summit, key EU players held talks with Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras. Greece will soon run out of money. International creditors are willing to lend the country billions of euro over the next 4 months to keep it afloat, but they are demanding that the Greek government provides details on how it intends to pay back enormous debts that are currently outstanding. Greece's new anti-austerity government is threatening to hold a referendum on leaving the euro currency if a compromise is not reached. Analysts say it is possible that citizens might vote yes if given the opportunity.
If you would ask me a month or 2 months ago what would be the outcome, I would say, okay, Greeks wants to stay in the euro. But if this goes on and there is hostility and there's negotiations and no breakthrough, and if they keep refusing Greece liquidity, then people might say, okay.
Analysts say there is a lack of joined up thinking within the EU when it comes to domestic and foreign policy.
Eurosceptic political parties and a large number of campaign groups say that these summits prove that the European Union is dysfunctional. While millions of the bloc citizens continue to suffer the consequences of a prolonged economic crisis, EU leaders struggle to agree on a whole range of other highly important policy issues. Jerome Hughes, Press TV, at the European Council, Brussels.
Tensions are also becoming apparent between the U.S. and Germany, this time over whistleblower Edward Snowden, as RT's Kevin Owen reports.
The U.S. has apparently been threatening Germany that it will sever intelligence-sharing ties if it gives asylum to whistleblower Edward Snowden, or even simply lets him visit. The claim comes from the German vice-chancellor and was revealed by journalist Glenn Greenwald, who's, of course, one of Snowden's closest allies. It's not the first time Berlin's been given the cold shoulder in the wake of the NSA scandal either. Earlier this month, we reported on how the U.K. refused to cooperate with Germany over its inquiry into the tapping of Chancellor Merkel's phone. Remember that story when it blew up? Britain's GCHQ also promised to cancel intelligence sharing with Berlin if it probes too deep into the issue as well. Let's talk now to former MI5 agent and now whistleblower Annie Machons, joining us live on the line from Germany. Hi, Annie. End of the day, isn't it up to Germany to decide, as a sovereign country for itself, who it does or doesn't let into its own country? Why does the US think it can threaten Berlin like this?
Well, the US thinks it can threaten most countries. In fact, they have a track record of doing this already with the UK in trying to suppress evidence of torture during a high court case in the UK a few years ago. So this is, if it's true, it's perfectly standard tactics that the US uses to diplomatically bully other countries that they want to break and bring to their heel. Of course, the other slightly disingenuous approach from the Vice Chancellor might be that it didn't actually happen, but he's saying it did, in order to shuffle off the blame for his party's failure to provide justified asylum to Edward Snowden within Germany. Mm. Now, he's part of the Social Democratic Party, one of the ruling coalition parties, and they have come under increasing pressure domestically within Germany to try and give Snowden asylum. So either it is legitimate bullying or it is just a very convenient excuse to blame the US for a failure of policy within Germany.
What's the word on the street there? Is it likely to happen? And as you say, this has been coming from the opposition. This has been put forward. Is it likely to happen at the end of the day, do you think?
I doubt very much that it will happen at the end of the day. And I have to say as well, if I were Edward Snowden, I would be very wary of coming to any European country. I think Russia is probably one of the very few countries in the world that can has the political will to give him asylum and a refuge, but also has the physical means to physically protect him. So even if Edward Snowden were guaranteed that he could be given asylum in Germany, there is no guarantee whatsoever that the CIA might not send in a snatch squad to extradite him, to sort of disappear him and put him on trial in the US.
We've also heard, of course, we're talking about relations there. Just this story was a little while back, but it's worth bearing up in mind. Former NSA chief saying that Germany will never be allowed into that so-called Five Eyes intelligence alliance. It does tell you a bit more about what's going on behind the scenes here in relations between Germany and America at the moment, doesn't it?
It does very much, and it's rather shocking in a way if you think about it. Germany has bent over backwards to accommodate the demands of the NSA over the last few years. We know that from the Snowden disclosures, including developing programs such as X-Key Score to take all the information in real time from electronic communications. And indeed, apparently the BND was reported recently to be hoovering up 220 million electronic communications per day within
Germany. So what's America's problem? Why doesn't America
trust
Germany
at
the moment? Why doesn't America seem to trust Germany? Surely it would welcome Snowden going there to be questioned, at least on German soil, because he's not being questioned at the moment. One step forward it would be, wouldn't it? For them.
Well, it would, yes. And then, of course, you have a situation where perhaps they didn't threaten. Perhaps this is just posturing by German politicians to get rid of the blame for not allowing Snowden to come. It's a very murky world. But yes, it would be to their advantage, I think, to get Snowden into Germany. It'd be much easier for them to get their hands on him than it is if he's in Russia, where he has safe haven.
A petition drive is underway that began in Venezuela and is spreading around the globe, calling on the U.S. president to revoke his declaration last week, calling the Bolivarian Socialist Republic a threat to U.S. national security. CCTV's Marty Markovitz reports from Caracas.
There's a signature drive going on in Venezuela, but it's not an ordinary one. Thousands of Venezuelans are answering President Nicolas Maduro's call to petition U.S. President Barack Obama to repeal his executive order classifying Venezuela as a national security threat. 55-year-old Luis Araga not only signed the petition, but also enlisted in the Bolivarian militia, which has seen its rank surge since tensions flared with the U.S.
If it's possible to do this at 90 years old, I will do it. This is my country. It's my homeland. It's the revolution. It's the nation. These are the things that are in play now. How can you live with yourself if you don't do everything possible to defend the country?
Maduro is hoping to rally massive public support after Washington levied sanctions on 7 high-level government officials accused of violating human rights during anti-government protests.
Y nos vamos a las calles a recoger 10 millones de firmas para la derogación del decreto imperial de Obama. ¿Están de acuerdo? Ustedes van a firmar.
In the past week, demonstrations against the United States have erupted across Venezuela. They are protesting Obama's recent actions against the Maduro government.
The Venezuelan president says Caracas poses no threat to the U.S. and that Obama's declaration is an attempt to destabilize his socialist government. A number of Latin American countries have come to Maduro's defense.
Debería entender de una vez.
The U.S. needs to understand, once and for all, that it cannot seduce or buy Cuba, just as it cannot intimidate Venezuela. Our unity is indestructible.
Some analysts say that Obama's recent move has been a godsend to Maduro. Faced with a low approval rating and a huge economic crisis, the recent spat has allowed him to mobilize his base ahead of key parliamentary elections.
Up to this point, it has been helping him because of the nationalistic rally that has been developing around him. The opposition has been quite cautious about this in order to be politically correct.
And that despite the political tensions, commercial relations between the two countries have not been hurt. The U.S. is still Venezuela's biggest trading partner and largest buyer of its oil. Martin Markovitz, CCTV, Caracas.
In the run-up to Israeli elections earlier this week, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that there would not be a Palestinian state so long as he held office, a public statement of opposition to the so-called two-state solution that many observers have accused him of holding privately for years. The Obama administration has warned that holding on to this position could cost Israel a key element of U.S. support. Press TV's Waqar Rizvi has more.
The U.S. government has reacted to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's election campaign pledge not to allow for the establishment of a Palestinian state. The White House is warning that it may halt diplomatic cover for Tel Aviv at the United Nations.
What is apparent is that in the context of the campaign, and while he was the sitting Prime Minister of Israel, he walked back from commitments that Israel had previously made to a two-state solution.
The United States has for decades vetoed UN Security Council resolutions meant to condemn Israel for its human rights violations. Washington has also opposed moves at the UN to recognize a Palestinian state, saying it must be part of a negotiated deal with Israel. However, Netanyahu's promise ahead of recent elections in Israel to not allow a Palestinian state has angered the administration of President Barack Obama. The Israeli premier later watered down his remarks. He said, for a two-state solution, current circumstances have to change.
CPR's Bernard White spoke with Phyllis Bennis from the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington about both the domestic and international implications of Likud's apparent upset victory this week.
Well, I think that there will be little change in the relationship with the United States. The tension that exists between Netanyahu and Obama exists and will not change. I think that the good news, actually, is that the blatant racism of Netanyahu's campaigning has led Obama to consider a change in U.S. policy for the first time. It's not a big change. It's not probably a significant change. But the fact that there is a change in response is very, very important. The potential change is that the U.S. might allow a Security Council resolution to go through that it vetoed a couple of years ago that ironically basically just restates longstanding U.S. policy about two states and withdrawing from parts of the occupied West Bank, a settlement freeze. But in the past, the U.S. vetoed it because it was not prepared to allow any debate, any discussion, certainly any resolution regarding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict to take place at the United Nations. It was simply off the agenda. We are going to have U.S.-controlled bilateral negotiations between Israel and Palestine, and that's how it's going to work, period, full stop. All of a sudden, we're hearing last night and this morning that the White House is considering going back to the Security Council to pass that resolution, which would be a very important signal to the Israelis that this kind of intransigence is not going to be accepted forever. So that's a very, very important symbolic move. It's only symbolic, but it's an important symbol. At the same time, you have a scenario where in Europe, there have been moves towards the imposition of real sanctions against Israel. And if there had been, for example, a victory by the centrist coalition led by Herzog, that would have ended immediately. There would have been a huge sigh of relief, both in the U.S. and in Europe, with everybody saying, ah, thank God, now we can go back to normal, we can go back to the peace talks. That would have been the mantra, back to the peace talks. And as we know, the peace talks went on for 24 years and accomplished nothing except the expansion of settlements. So in that context, it's actually, again, quite useful to have a symbol of Israeli extremism, although ironically, Netanyahu does not represent the most extreme wing. He will be actually closer to the left side of his government, as horrific as that sounds. He will be governing a coalition made up of mainly forces significantly to his right. And when that's the case, having somebody as provocative and bullying as Netanyahu in charge is actually a good thing because it shows it up for what it is. There's no illusions. You don't have a situation where the U.S. can say, well, there may be some problematic elements in the Israeli government, but overall they support a two-state solution, they support our values. You know, when you have somebody making these racist attacks on Palestinian citizens of Israel, calling on his voters to come out and vote because the Arabs, as he put it, the Arabs are coming out to vote in droves. That was his line, and it just sounded like Bull Connor or George Wallace in the mid '60s in the South, warning white voters to come out because those Negroes, except they wouldn't have said that, are coming out in droves. It was a shocking thing to hear. And I think that, as much as anything else, really pushed the Obama administration to finally react.
You think that he might have overplayed his hand? I mean, coming in to speak to the Congress and appealing to this establishing.
No, I don't think he overplayed his hand because it worked. He won. His congressional move was primarily about his own election. This is a man whose primary ideological commitment is to power, to remaining in power. And it worked. I mean, that's the really horrifying thing. This kind of racist assault worked in Israel. And I think that in that context, he didn't overplay his hand. What he did was consolidate the partisan divide over Israel, which is a relatively new development. It's been taking shape for some time, but this really kind of confirmed it, that support for Israel, the kind of uncritical, absolutist support that has for so long been a highlight of U.S., or a lowlight, if you will, of U.S. foreign policy, is now far more popular among Republicans than it is among Democrats. That's new. That's a new reality. And forced that into a consolidated position. That weakens Israel if it's seen as a partisan issue rather than a bipartisan issue. And it opens the way for those who have worked in this country for so many years to change U.S. policy. It opens the way for members of Congress, even if at first it's for silly partisan reasons. If that's the basis on which they can begin to criticize Israel, that's all to the good.
Right, and that's what I meant by overplayed his hand. I think that he might have put into motion a deeper scrutiny of Israel and its policies. I think that this what he did with Obama is not going to go away. That there are going to be a lot of folks who are going to be upset for a long time over that action.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right.
So, you know, one of the things that we get focused on by media is the Obama's relationship to Netanyahu. But that's just some gossip, really.
You're right. That's not the important part. I mean, it's important to keep in mind that even during the height of the tension between Obama and Netanyahu, the policy of the United States never changed. And in fact, Netanyahu has said on a number of occasions that Obama has been the most pro-Israeli president there's ever been. And that's based on not being warm and fuzzy with the prime minister. It's based on the absolutism of the commitment to $3.1 billion a year in military aid, $250 million extra this year for the Iron Dome system, complete protection at the United Nations, complete protection against Israel ever being held accountable in the International Criminal Court. All of those things are the fundamentals of the relationship that Israel wants to maintain. And if that means putting up with a president who doesn't like the prime minister, that's fine. They can deal with that. So the reality of the relationship really has not changed.
Right, absolutely, and that's how media gets us to focus on the trivialities as opposed to looking really at squarely at some of the really important issues. How is this playing in the region? I would imagine that if I was a neighbor of Israel and I saw that there was an even more right wing coalition coming into prominence, I would have to, I would be a little, not afraid, but I certainly would have to, well, maybe afraid.
I think that in the region there's actually less concern about the election than there is here, because the shift is more political than strategic when you look at foreign affairs. Just a couple of days before the election, the head of the centrist coalition, the Zionist Union, Herzog, had said, there is no daylight between me and Netanyahu on the question of Iran. So there wouldn't have been any difference there. The difference would have been in the rhetoric. The difference would have been in his commitment to rebuild the relationship with the U.S., which Netanyahu is not as interested in, and his right wing certainly is not interested in. But he would be equally demanding of a complete Iranian surrender on the question of nuclear power, et cetera, et cetera. So that isn't likely to change. The part that could get interesting is that in the context of the rise of ISIS and the regional and global war against ISIS that the U.S. is leading, you do have a situation where the Arab leaders in the Gulf in particular, the Saudis, Qatar, Kuwait, Oman, the UAE, etc., these Arab leaders are very uneasy because they see Iran, their regional rival, particularly for the Saudis. Iran is the regional rival, the Shia versus Sunni quest for domination, etc., as well as the national hegemonic question, who's going to be the regional hegemon, Iran or Saudi Arabia. In all of that, suddenly Iran emerges as the key force fighting back against ISIS. And that's making everybody very nervous because they find themselves depending on Iran in ways that they don't want to. And Israel is in that same position. That was why, when he came to Congress, Netanyahu focused a lot of his speech on how no one should view Iran as an ally, even though it's acting like an ally in going after ISIS. So he said this thing of, in the question of Iran and ISIS, the enemy of your enemy is still your enemy. And he kept repeating that because he's worried that what's at stake, if there is a real U.S.-Iranian rapprochement, is a real change in the regional balance of forces, including who the U.S. views as its key allies. So that's a really important potential. If there is going to be an agreement that goes beyond the particulars of the nuclear power question to include the issue of U.S. relations in the region and some kind of a grand bargain between the U.S. and Iran, you have the potential for a real shift where Iran becomes recognized by the U.S. and the West as what it is, which is a major regional player. It's wealthy, it's stable, it has water, it has land, it has an educated population. You know, what's not to like as a regional power? So in that context, both Israel and the Arab states are very worried that the U.S. is going to shift towards some kind of accommodation with Iran that's going to leave them as secondary allies of the U.S. And that's, in fact, a possibility. I don't think that the re-election of Netanyahu particularly changes that equation.
Aside from the response from the White House, Netanyahu was criticized by many of Israel's strongest supporters in the U.S., including the New York Times, for both his promise that there would never be a Palestinian state so long as he was in office, and for his almost apocalyptic claim on the eve of the election that what he called droves of Arab voters could overwhelm the numbers of Jewish Israelis. But according to author and political science professor Norman Finkelstein, the outcome of the Israeli election in the face of such talk tells more about the Israeli electorate than about the prime minister himself. He made his comments during a taping of the RT program Crosstalk Thursday.
Well, all the analysis show that in the last few days, Benjamin Netanyahu ran on two particular points. Number one, no to a Palestinian state. And number two, he was engaged in racist fear-mongering, telling the Israeli Jewish electorate that the Arabs were voting in droves and that you have to go out to stop this Arab piling up at the polls. And that's what swung the last about 4 or 5 percentage points in Netanyahu's favor. Now, I agree that crazy things are happening in the region, that's for sure. You have the crazy ISIS in Syria and elsewhere. You have the crazy Saudis, and you also have, of course, the crazy Israelis. I'm not going to sing patriotic songs to the United States. We have our racial problems for sure. We have racist police. We have a racist judicial system. But the fact of the matter is, in the last two elections, the American people twice elected a black person to office, an African American. In the case of Israel, they've just elected the grand dragon of the Ku Klux Klan into office. There's a lot of lunacy going on in Israel. And the true face of the Israeli electorate gives a good insight into the nature of the Israeli mentality, telling us that the entire world, every single world leader who said that Netanyahu came out against the Palestinian state Everybody is wrong. Everybody's suffering from an illusion. Everybody's suffering from a delusion. The New York Times is wrong. All the world leaders are wrong. But actually, Benjamin Netanyahu came out in favor of two states. That's the Israeli mentality. It has nothing to do with the real world. It's clear Benjamin Netanyahu never supported two states, and now he came out openly against it. And the Israeli electorate, because it's not just Mr. Netanyahu, but it's all the parties to the right of Netanyahu who oppose two states, they form a majority of Israel.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.